Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Thursday, August 21st, and starting with some breaking news this morning, Dr. James Dobson, as many of our AFR family listeners are very familiar with, advocate and founder of the James Dobson Family Institute and Focus on the Family, has gone to be with the Lord at 89 years old. So he was one of the most influential Christian leaders of the last half century and a tireless advocate for the traditional family. He passed away on August 21st, 2025, at the age of 89. The press release goes on to say, a psychologist, New York Times best-selling author, Radio Hall of Fame broadcaster, and advisor to five U.S. presidents, Dr. Dobson dedicated his life to strengthening marriages, guiding parents, and defending biblical values by championing the central role of family in America. And for those listeners who don't know, I have a personal connection with Dr. Dobson. I actually worked for him at the James Dobson Family Institute as his policy director prior to then working for President Trump. Got to know him personally and just had an incredible experience there and seeing his love and passion for continuing in his ministry literally until the day that he died. And I respect that so much about ministers like him, like Pastor John MacArthur and others who understand that retirement in terms of ministry really isn't in the Bible. For the days that the Lord has us here on this earth, we have work to do for him, not necessarily just for ourselves and our own glory and our own purposes. We always have work to do for the Lord, and he was a wonderful embodiment of that. So be praying for his family and also for those at the James Dobson Family Institute. I know that they just absolutely loved him so much. So let's welcome in Steve Dace, a good friend of the show and radio host at The Blaze. And Steve, I know that you knew Dr. Dobson and his impact, so I want to get your thoughts, and then we'll move on to this next topic that I want to get your commentary on. Good morning.
Good morning, Jenna. And I had not heard this news until you just told me a few minutes ago. And, you know, I don't use this term a lot. Frankly, I don't think there's a lot of men in our era worthy of such a term, but just an absolute titan. And I think I've one of the most salient observations as a guy who does a biblical worldview show I've heard in my career, and I have cited him with this so many times on my show, I can't even count. So I probably owe him a residual royalty of a substantial amount. But there's really only two worldviews when you break it all down. God is or he isn't. And that is exactly right. And that's pretty much what every fight, every battle, every debate, not just we have, you know, within the political culture rubric nexus that people like you and I discuss on forums like this every day, but really in our homes, in our marriages, in our families, in our churches, in our communities. Everything really boils down to those two worldview discussions. And within those discussions, I would say there's a lot of different isms within those discussions, right? Human beings are not formulas or algorithms. We're complicated vehicles of 2 trillion cells. We're the only, as far as we know, we're the only beings made in the image of God in this universe, which means we have a body, soul, mind, and spirit, right? So within those, you know, working mechanisms, particularly when you throw sin into the mix, there's going to be a lot of different room, have to be a lot of room for nuance and complications, and thank God that mercy triumphs over judgment. But in the end, when you boil all those isms down, they fall into one of two camps. God is or he isn't, And that's essentially what Dr. Dobson made his ministry about throughout his career. And for people that are younger and don't know, he had a very successful ministry as kind of the boomer era counter to Dr. Spock, with biblical insights on marriage and parenting. That Spock is a huge influence coming out of the counterculture with urging a lot of America and the West to abandon. And he could have just stayed in that realm and had, he was hugely popular, high favorables, very respected. But he saw the broader need of the culture and where we were heading and realized that a lot of the issues he fought for that were happening in marriages and families were downstream from the main reservoir that was dumping this stuff into the water table. And so he risked a lot of that likability and a lot of that broader cultural cachet to get involved in the process, to wage war on that level. And, of course, then you suffer the collateral damage for doing so. Again, people like you and I live in this world all along. I tried to get out several years ago, actually, and did an audition for ESPN Radio. And they told me I did great. And then after doing a background on me, they said, there's no way we can hire you, man. You've got way too much political baggage. And that's essentially the choice that Dr. Dobson made. He knew that getting into this fight was going to cause a loss of some of his broader cachet and success. But he thought the country was worth it. The future was worth it. And that's a model and an example to set for others. And we're seeing now some great leaders pass away. And I think the question on the table is, mm-hmm. has that generation done enough to set up the next generation to pick up from where they left off? Are they doing that? Because I agree, retirement in the kingdom of God, and hey, we're not talking to guys who spent 40 years breaking their back, roofing in 100-degree heat, all right? But in a broader sense, retirement in the kingdom of God is not this notion that we just, you know, pop the clutch and settle down is really not a biblical concept in the broader scope. But part of that, though, is are we preparing the next generation? I think, you know, what happened to him, and now's not the time to adjudicate that, but what happened to him at Focus I don't think was right. And I think the direction that ministry has taken since his departure speaks for itself. And that's a challenge that we have is we all know the names of the previous, those of us that have been in this space for a while, we know the names of the previous and older generation and the main men who helped lead those fights. But who are the names of the men that are emerging to take their place? We don't know their names. And that is concerning. And it is one of the reasons why, frankly, you see a political movement like MAGA out ahead of the church in a lot of these confrontations with evil in our culture at the moment. We don't know who that's going to be yet.
And that is very concerning, and that's absolutely the question. And, you know, Steve, going back to your experience with that interview, you may have a lot of political baggage, but we have no burdens because we have laid those at the foot of the cross, and that is 100% worth it, and why people like you and I do what we do, and why people like James Dobson, John MacArthur, and the stalwart generation that is now passing away continued on in ministry, because we know that there's something greater than politics, there's greater than ourselves, and that's what we fight for every day. And you're absolutely right that the question mm-hmm. is who is coming in the next generation, and are there leaders that aren't just the godless populace that may want good things like capitalism and the Constitution and freedom and liberty? Those things are all great, but if they're not grounded in a moral fabric and a moral foundation, then eventually you get to a conflicting worldview that is not based on, is God true or is he not? And that is the ultimate question. And this actually gets to the topic that we originally were going to talk about this argument simmering on the right that you posted about. And I'm not going to read this whole post, but basically the question is whether the Constitution is still effective in maintaining order and preserving our way of life. And I think this is a very important question for today's moment, because we're seeing a lot of the next generation on the right really depart from the values and the worldview statement embedded in our Declaration of Independence. And now the Constitution, as you know, listeners know, that's just the nuts and bolts of how our founders decided to set up our constitutional republic. They could have done this in a wide variety of ways. It was the mandate of the Declaration that say our rights are pre-political, come from God, our creator, and government, a legitimate government, is obligated to preserve and protect those. How do we best do that? And I think that question is still debatable today. How do we best do that? And so what do we think about this question, Steve? How do we best preserve our God-given rights? Not civil rights, like, you know, this nonsense about, you know, equal protection for gay marriage and, you know, all this other stuff that's just totally invented. How do we actually protect the truth of God's authority in government for the next generation and beyond?
Well, this is a debate that I think people who have you and I's worldview or a biblical worldview are going to have to be willing to listen. And I'm not even talking, when I say both sides, I'm not talking right and left. The left is not a part of this discussion, which is why we are having it. And that's the first point that I was trying to make by even, I've paid attention to this debate for the last couple of years. I've not said anything about it and kind of listened to everybody's arguments. And because I think we have to be careful how we enter into this debate on our side, because there are two sides on our side with this debate. And I think we have to first and foremost, Jenna, recognize, those of us with a biblical worldview, that we are having this debate at all because the left has abandoned our way of life. And in fact, is now full throat in the process of trying, of invading it, of hostily invading it. All right. When I see someone like my friend Jack Hibbs in California, And Jack is an evangelist, is an evangelical, is evangelical. All right. I mean, he's from Calvary. He's out of the Calvary Chapel tradition. There isn't a sect of American Protestantism that is more aggressively into evangelism than the Calvary Chapel movement. Its birth was glamorized in the movie Jesus Revolution a couple of years ago. And Jack has made his life in that state, trying to fight spiritual warfare there. And so this isn't, and Jack's, you know, and I'm not here to have an argument about Arminianism and Calvinism. That's not the, but I'm bringing this up because you need to understand the context of Jack's theology. Jack is a devoted Arminian, all right, a very vocal critic of Calvinistic theology. So he'd have disagreed with John MacArthur, for example, on quite a bit, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we're not here to referee the fight between Hibbs and MacArthur, because we've been having that fight in the church for 2,000 years. What I'm bringing this up so your audience understands the potency of what I'm going to say next. When that guy reaches a point where he warns his people and churchgoers and spirit-filled believers in California, we may be on the brink of all having to leave this state. That should tell you something, all right? Because his theological framework is to stay and fight, to engage, to get your hands dirty, to occupy till he comes. He's a committed dispensationalist. He's a committed pre-mill guy, all right? And so when he is at the point where what they're about to do in California is the Colorado legislation on steroids, when that's on Newsom's desk to be signed as we speak, and he's like, hey, we just maybe can't live here. I mean, this is abomination of desolation kind of stuff is what Jack is saying. All right, it's time to flee, you know, to Petra here, okay? When we're there, right, then I think we need to understand that this debate is being offered on our side because the two previous sides, right and left, one of them has abandoned the relationship, has filed for divorce, is not going to reconcile, is not returning, and is not coming back, and instead is trying to force the court to take the kids with them, as well as the house, the property, and everything else. And so when that happens, when one spouse abandons the other and then turns into a hostile force against the other half of the family, there is going to be division in that half of the family about how best to proceed. And I think it is very important we understand why we are having this debate on the right. It is not because a bunch of red-pilled, Bronze Age pervert, you know, Nick Fuentes followers have gotten a foothold on X and somehow permeated via Twitter the entire right-wing water supply. Now, that phenomenon does exist, and it's disgusting, okay? But that's not what prompted this, all right? There's always been this kind of element that, you know, we've always had to flirt with this on our side, just like they've always had to flirt with Marxism and communists on their side from the very beginning, right? The difference is now they're not flirting with them anymore. It's conjugal. They've consummated the relationship, all right? They're having gay race communist families as we speak, okay? So what's happening on our side is it's in reaction to that. It is very clear now our old way of life, as taken for granted by every previous generation, can no longer be taken for granted. And so there, we must admit this is true. And if we don't admit this is true, we've already lost the argument. And if you're worried about what people like Joe Webin says, who I know personally, don't always agree with, but I've known Joel for years, and a more extreme version of Joel would be Nick Fuentes, whom I don't know at all and find to be a complete creep. But if you're worried about what guys like that say, the spectrum somewhere between Joel Webin and Nick Fuentes, understand this. If people that with our belief system do not recognize the reality of where the left is and what they've done and what they will do and are doing, you're going to funnel way more people to Joel Webin and a more extreme version, Nick Fuentes, than we could. That's the best argument for figures like that there could possibly be. We must address this, Jenna. We're not going to reconcile. And therefore, right? It is an obvious question to ask. If there's not a marriage, well, what do we do with this marriage covenant then? That's essentially the question. All right, the people existed before the Constitution. The Constitution is just a rubric for what the Declaration of Independence means. Right? What's Christianity based on? Most Christians will say the Bible. No, it's not. It's based on Christ. Mm-hmm. For if Christ be not raised, your preaching is in vain, and you're all still dead in your sins. Now, in light of the fact he's been raised, the Word of God is placed into its full context and authority, right? And it's a clarification of the mission. What does that actually mean? How do we live this out? What kind of people ought we to be, as Peter asks in his epistles? That's kind of the relationship of our founding documents. The country's based on the Declaration of Independence, and it was ratified, 13 years before the Constitution was? So there was a people already. The most important words of the Constitution are "we the people," because it indicates there was a country, and that country was its people before there was a Constitution. We learned painfully post 9/11, we are not simply a system of governance that you can download into a flash drive, take it over to the Middle East, put it through Google Translate into Arabic, plug it into one of their flash drives in Kabul and Baghdad, and just absolutely download our system of government and make them like us. We learned that that's not the case. We the people is the most important phrase. Who were these people? What was their culture? What was their shared values? What brought them together? What codified that social compact among them that they then desired to go ahead and say, here's now how we're going to live. Here's the rules for how we're going to live together, right? We have to answer that question. And we cannot, the argument, and I'm going to say this again, and Tim Wellman, forgive me. The argument Larry Arn, great man, by the way, the argument he's having at Hillsdale about it becoming a Christian nation, with all due respect, and I said this all day on my show yesterday, that's an argument that it's either too early for or too late for. Larry is having a post-Enlightenment, post-Reformation, how do all these Christian sects now live together when they're killing each other and they're founding colonies in this new world and they're all vestiges of the church and the Congregationalists in Connecticut are not letting the Baptists run for office and everybody has to pay taxes to the denomination and nobody likes the Catholics in Maryland, right? And we just got done our ancestors killing each other on the battlefields of Europe. We aren't to that point or it's too late for that conversation. Because what happened in Dearborn, Michigan, about an hour away from Hillsdale College last Sunday, is 40,000 Muslims just walked across Larry's front lawn there at Hillsdale College to go out there and call a call to prayer and Sharia law like it was downtown Mecca or Cairo, and it was a suburb of Detroit. All right? We don't have the luxury of that conversation. We're in the world now where Charles Martel and the Pope get together and say, we might have to form an empire because the Muslims just took Vienna and they're a block away from Paris. That's where we are. We must know what time it is. And if we act with this esoteric, philosophical high-mindedness and sanctimony, like we're in some post-Enlightenment world, and we now have to figure out how to referee these sectarian arguments with various Christian denominations and beliefs, we're going to lose America.
Well said, Steve. And, you know, this is a much longer conversation, but I think that's the crux of the issue, is that we do have to recognize what time it is and where we go from here. And this is why it's so important to raise up the next generation understanding the biblical worldview and why the Declaration is actually far, far more important than the U.S. Constitution. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is sending his Lieutenant Governor Jay Collins to California to pick up the fugitive, this trucker who is an illegal immigrant from India who killed three motorists after making an illegal U-turn on his big rig on Florida's Turnpike. And DeSantis is saying state lines won't protect criminal illegals and sends the Chuck Norris of Florida deputy to nab the fugitive trucker. So Lieutenant Governor Jay Collins joins me now from, I usually say the great state of, but I really have to say the terrible state of California. So I'm actually so sorry, Lieutenant Governor, that you have to be in California right now. But thank you so much for being there, for your service to Floridians to help bring about justice in this case. So good morning. Tell us more about what's going on here.
Yeah. Hey, good morning, Jenna. First off, thanks for having me on here. And, you know, last time I traveled, it was actually over to the Middle East. So this is it's a small step up. You know, it's a little bit different. So it could be worse. There's no one shooting at me today. No ballistic missiles. So big win.
Best look, you can say about California.
Yeah, right. You know, when you look at what the governor just said in that statement, it's incredible. You know, I dream of a government that cares enough about its people to step up, step forward, to fly across the country and ensure that this thug, this criminal who took the lives of three innocent Floridians is brought home and will face the long arm of justice. He's going to get the book thrown at him, as Governor DeSantis said, and he's held accountable. It doesn't matter if you run to California, to Washington, to Oregon, wherever the case may be, Florida will stand by our people. We're going to make sure that accountability comes in the form of the court system, and he's held accountable. And ultimately, that's what leadership should do. Why is it important to have your leaders, your governor, your lieutenant governor, step up and fight for our citizens like this? Because leadership matters. Principles matter. Standing up and going forward, the act of saying, I will do all that I can to come back home, make sure that these people are held accountable, that he faces time in jail for what he did, for ending those innocent lives, that matters. That's why we have a responsibility to do this, and I'm so proud of the governor for allowing us to do this, for stepping forward and doing the right thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is why leadership matters. Absolutely. And this is why Floridians, I think, just respect Governor DeSantis and you so much as our executive team, because it's not just about words, it's about actions. And so everything that is promised to Floridians is then acted upon. And we don't see that, unfortunately, in a lot of even Republican leadership throughout the country. There's a lot of grandiose promises, even over in the state of Texas, to hold, you know, the derelict Democrats accountable. Is anything actually happening over there? I just had another state rep on yesterday talking about, well, no, not really. And nothing's going to happen. And so the difference, I think, between a state like Texas and a state like Florida is that you and Governor DeSantis are promising accountability and you're actually delivering.
That's right. I mean, let's look at the case on this. 2018, he crosses the border illegally. We know that he doesn't seem to understand English. He doesn't understand road signs. He finished he failed his tests on the side of the road post-incident, fled back to California. And absolutely, the governor has been on top of this. I am standing with our state, standing with our people, and we're going to come forward. But in the end, that's exactly what our people need. They are tired of politicians who just run their mouth, say things, do nothing, and make the next promise after the next promise. Governor DeSantis uses this word all the time. I've used this since I was in the military, and it's deeds, not words. It is all about what you say, following through, be a man of conviction, say what you mean what you say, and follow up with actions. And that does define Florida. most assuredly under the Governor DeSantis time frame here in our great state. And, you know, we're not going to go back. We are not going to fall back to what other states do. We're going to keep pressing the gas pedal. Doesn't matter what they throw at us, how this game is played. We are going to step up. We're going to fight for our people. And we're going to continue to get this right.
Yeah, and I really respect that. And I'm speaking with Lieutenant Governor Jay Collins out of the great state of Florida, who's there in California today to escort this truck driver back to Florida to face justice. And for Floridians, instead of just allowing him to be deported or saying, you know, it's ICE's problem, no, it's Florida's justice first. And you know, Governor DeSantis had some great words to say about you, sir, when he appointed you Lieutenant Governor, saying, you know, you're the future of the state of Florida. What does this office mean to you and the future of Florida?
Well, you know, I have tried to provide value and I've tried to make a difference in every single thing that I've done. Make a difference for the people around you. If you are given the opportunity to step up and lead more, well, then lead. You know, we all have to follow. We all have to lead depending on how life aligns. What does it mean to me? It means that I have earned the trust of someone who I have the utmost respect for, someone who I have stood for and fought behind for the last multiple years I've been in office. And ultimately, what it really means more than anything is I have an opportunity to do something that matters, and that's leave things better than we got it. You've heard me talk about it for many years. I am blessed to be the Lieutenant Governor of Florida. I was blessed to become a Green Beret and serve amongst the elite, people who I look up to and have just amazing amounts of respect and belief in, guys who far, far outpace myself. But more than anything, I am a husband and I'm a dad. And I want to make sure that these things that we love, these truths that we hold to be self-evident, that we protect and preserve those for our kids because, man, they deserve every single thing they have and so much more. They deserve the American dream. And if we don't preserve it for them, what are they going to have? The rest of the world is losing its way. This is the last best hope for our nation. Florida leads the way. We are the conservative proving grounds of America. And, you know, it's great to have the president doing what he's doing in the White House. But look at all the things they're trying to do. We did them here in Florida, and we have to continue to lead. And that's what this means to me.
And yeah, the truths that we hold self-evident is based on the biblical worldview. And I know that, you know, Governor DeSantis is a faithful Christian. You are as well. And that's meaningful in terms of leadership. And I know that's a priority for Floridians to have that type of leadership. And so talk a little bit about your background. And you were a state senator before this appointment, and you've been on this program multiple times in that capacity. But for those who may not be as familiar with your background, why public service, especially as a veteran, as a Green Beret, why this means so much to you?
Jenna, thank you for that. That's a great question. And, you know, I didn't dream of politics. I got to be honest. There are 23.5 million people here in the state of Florida. And at any time, you're going to have, you know, 11, 12 million people who don't agree with what you're doing. It's not about consensus. It's about doing what's right. You know, when you look back to COVID, you look back to Afghanistan, you saw what happened across our nation. There was a bright spot right here in Florida where leadership stood. We realized what needed to be done, and we stood strong. We were bold, and we led across the country. Where would our nation be if we hadn't done these things? You know, I look at what we did to our kids and muzzling them. I think the long-term deficits that we're going to be dealing with are just now coming to the surface, and it breaks my heart to see what we've done and what the response is going to be over time. I think back to Afghanistan, when we pulled out of Afghanistan and we broke our promise to people we'd fought beside for two decades. I think about the families that paid the price, families that lost their loved ones, people who came home injured and broken, and leadership matters. I realized really quickly that if you want to fix the problem, we're going to have to get involved in politics. And though it wasn't my dream, let peace come in my children's time. Let war come in mine. Let me step forward and fight for what matters. Let me take care of these things that have to be done. So God willing, I do what I have to do, and my kids get to do what they want to do. And, you know, that's what I hope. That's what I dream. That's what I pray for, that my kids have a better life than we do. And ultimately, that's why we do what we do. That's why this matters. Pass this on and take care of the next generation.
And Lieutenant Governor Jay Collins, I think you just perfectly described the difference between a statesman like yourself and a politician. And this is why I have so much respect for you and Governor DeSantis as the leaders of Florida, because of that view. And, you know, you're getting a lot of pushback, though. And I do want to ask you about this Florida Politics article that was just absolute nonsense, completely false. It's pushing this false claim that somehow you were talking to another state representative, agreeing, somehow responding, saying that Governor DeSantis has Asperger's, which even if true, wouldn't matter at all. He's clearly, you know, a great governor, has a lot of wins. And I think that would just prove that, you know, he's a great, able to focus and great governor. But it didn't even make grammatical sense in the context. And I think that this was just framed by Florida Politics to try to divide the leadership between you and Governor DeSantis, where I don't see any daylight between the two of you. So can you respond to this allegation over this text exchange?
You know, a friend of mine, someone who I really have a lot of faith in, once told me they're going to attack you. They're going to come after you. And if they're not attacking you, you might want to question what you're doing. If they're attacking you, it means you're over the target. That was Governor DeSantis. So, look, I'm okay with that. I don't mind what they do to me. The reason that they did this, I honestly think, is exactly what you said. You're not driving a wedge between the governor and I. You're not driving a wedge between the governor, myself, and the state of Florida. We are going to step up. We are going to be bold. We are going to lead. I'm not going to stop fighting for our people. And it's heartbreaking. You know, Jenna, you and I have talked about this. I have two boys with my wife. We are blessed. We are 10 and 13. And we have dealt with a lot of stressors in our life. I would trade every single thing I have and everything I could be to make sure that they have a life that I dream of, you know, everything perfect. But they both have had to deal with unique things. And we have a loved one who's on the spectrum sometime, you know, and in some way, whether it's Asperger's or whatever else. And to use that language and to draw this into fire, man, we protect the innocent. We protect those who need support. We stand up and fight beside people, especially children who need help. And I just can't believe that this type of thing was utilized this way. It breaks my heart. And I hope and pray that there is nobody who has to deal with any stress because of the nonsense that came out of that Florida Politics article. And but I promise you this, it didn't diminish my resolve. If anything, it lights a fire, because I know that we're doing the right thing, and I am going to continue to fight for Florida. I'm not going to stop, and you are not going to use some lame story to frighten me, to stop me. You're not going to do it to the governor. So here we go. If that's the game we play, you've chosen the rules of engagement. We are where we are.
Let's go. And yeah, if you look at this text thread, clearly you're responding, agreeing that Governor DeSantis, is an incredibly successful governor. And I think nobody could disagree with that. So Lieutenant Governor Jay Collins, so last question for you then, is there an announcement maybe then forthcoming of fighting for Florida?
You know, I'm not, what is this, 8 days now, I think, Jenna, that I've been blessed to be in this seat. It has been busy. I'm not going to lie. We have been bouncing around the state, doing anything and everything we can to take care of our people. And, man, it's incredible. I am so blessed to have this opportunity. I'm going to tell you what my focus is. It's maximizing my ability to do this job. I want to be the best lieutenant governor I can be. On the 21st, I'm working for the greatest governor in our state's history. I want to make sure that that's my primary focus. You know, ultimately, will it deal with those next questions as these things come into view and get squared away a little bit more? But right now, task at hand is making sure we bring this thug home to take care of accountability, to let people know that our governor and myself are going to lead on this issue. He will face a long arm of justice. I'm going to be the best lieutenant governor I can be, fight him beside the best governor in our state's history. And we're going to leave Florida better than we got it. That's what our focus has to be right now.
Amazing. Well, and your press conference is at 10 a.m. Pacific time. And so We will tune in for that. And Lieutenant Governor Jay Collins from the great state of Florida in the very sad state right now of California. But you can follow Jay Collins at Jay Collins FL for Florida. I'd encourage you to do that to keep everything in view of what's going on in the great state of Florida. And hopefully we can export the great blueprint of Florida to other red states and encourage them to not just have words, but actually have action and accountability behind that. You know, listeners know that's exactly why I respect our leadership in Florida so much. So thank you so much, Lieutenant Governor, for dropping by and for the actions that you're taking. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. I want you to picture this. Her name is Kayla. She is 17, alone, terrified, and pregnant. Sitting in a clinic, tears blurring, thinking abortion is her only option. Until she was offered a free ultrasound, paid for by a hero just like you. The moment Kayla heard her baby's heartbeat, the decision was made. And today, her little baby boy, Gabriel, is thriving because preborn walked with Kayla every step of the way. Now multiply that by 38,000. That's how many babies preborn has helped save just this year. How many mothers preborn has come alongside with practical and spiritual resources to make motherhood possible. But here's the most important thing you will hear today. Their goal is to save 70,000 babies by the end of the year. And they can't do that without us. Every $28 provides that ultrasound, the moment everything changes. Will you be the reason the next Kayla chooses life? The reason Gabriel fulfills his destiny? To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or donate securely at preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. So in the midst of all of the lawfare that many of us, obviously myself, have personal experience with, we are asking the question of how to beat the left in court. Well, that's actually the subtitle of a great new book, The Last Line of Defense, How to Beat the Left in Court, by Senator Eric Schmidt, who is the former attorney general of the great state of Missouri. And he joins me now. And Senator Schmidt, I'm so excited to read this book because I think that is a really important question that we have to ask and answer, but especially from someone like you who really, as attorney general, I mean, you were at the forefront of a lot of these cases that then Andrew Bailey, who was your successor, built upon. But you did this in such a way that was exemplary, I think, in navigating the court process. So tell us more about your book and good morning.
Good morning. Good to hear you again. Yeah, that's why you wrote The Last Line of Defense, How to Beat the Left in Court. Everybody can get it on Amazon right now. It launched this week. But it's really, it's not just a history, but a playbook. It's concrete and actionable. I think left-wing lawfare is one of the most important stories of the second Trump administration. And this is how we beat them. And it really draws on experience. So if you think back, if you take the kind of DeLorean back in time just a few years, which I know some of this stuff, there's a tendency to want to forget about it because we had the lockdowns and we had compulsory COVID shots and open borders and struggle sessions and ESG requirements and a censorship regime. Well, those are the things that we set up and we fought back against. So Missouri led the charge on the COVID vaccine mandate case, took it to the Supreme Court, and we won. We had the student loan debt forgiveness case that Joe Biden, you know, pushed forward. That was $500 billion that we took to the Supreme Court and we won. And then probably most famously, filed the lawsuit Missouri versus Biden, which before Elon Musk bought Twitter, before the congressional hearings, exposed this vast censorship enterprise where big government was colluding and coordinating and coercing big tech giants to censor speech. Millions of voices censored over things like the Hunter Biden laptop story or mask mandates or the efficacy of the COVID shot, all that stuff. Government can't censor your speech. They also can't outsource it either. That's what was happening. We uncovered it. So I think your listeners are going to love it. It's kind of a behind-the-scenes look of what it was like to take the deposition of Anthony Fauci, what was it like to uncover the stuff with the FBI and take the deposition of the FBI agent that was pre-bunking the Hunter Biden laptop story in Northern California with big tech companies. So there's a lot of lessons learned here, but more importantly, it's a playbook on how we can keep fighting back and winning.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm speaking with U.S. Senator Eric Schmidt and his new book, The Last Line of Defense, How to Beat the Left in Court. And so with this playbook, is this a matter of fighting the fights that need fighting? Is it a matter of strategically bringing cases that you select that you know are advantageous in terms of winning? Or what's the overall strategy?
I think there's a couple of takeaways. One is understanding the landscape is really key. And I will tell you just, when I became Attorney General of Missouri, my focus was fighting violent crime, doing a lot of those things. And we did those things. We started a cold case unit. We were clearing sexual assault kits that had been, gathering dust on shelves. And we, doing all those sorts of things. When Biden came in, though, the mission changed dramatically because it was the most aggressively radical liberal administration in American history. I mean, we all know he was out to lunch and you've got these leftists who were, kind of running the White House. So the mission changed. So I think it was, for me, it was very eye-opening to see all the fronts that they're coming at you with. And it was highest levels of government with censorship. It's an apparatus that they had created where you have, like, how does a superintendent in Springfield, Missouri get so devoted to critical race theory in that school district, right? Well, it's part of this network. And so, just another story from The Last Line of Defense, How to Beat the Left in Court, people can get right now, is the training that takes place all across this country with teachers and staff and administrators to divide the room by race, who's the oppressor, who's the oppressed. And this is part of the training material. So one of the stories here is a parent was like, hey, there's something kind of goofy going on in my school. They wouldn't give them the documents. They wouldn't give them the training materials. And so a state representative gets involved. They said, okay, yeah, we'll give it to you. It's going to cost you $120,000. Well, so then we got involved. And what we found was this stuff was radical. I mean, it's obviously a lot of the trans ideology that was being infused in our kids' education, but it was also the thing called the oppression matrix. And in another school district, kids were being forced to do a privilege walk. I mean, crazy stuff that really understanding landscape, step one. Number two, and I think this is probably the most important message, and I think President Trump, one of his great gifts to the party is have the courage to fight back. So when we were suing 50 school districts in Missouri for their mask mandates on the peak day of Omicron, right, that kitchen was kind of hot. And you had these reporters interviewing you in their car with masks on because they weren't allowed in the studio because of COVID, right? So they're saying, why are you trying to kill the kids? This is their line of questioning. It's like, there's no evidence for this. Kids are being injured by being forced to wear masks all day long. There's psychological impact. They're making these rules up because adults should know better, but they're not, for whatever reason, they're not doing what they should do. They're quote unquote following the science. No one could question it. So anyway, I think part of this is understanding what we're up against and the courage to fight back. And there's the good news is I think if we do that, we can fight and we win. And we're seeing right now in Trump too, my former Solicitor General, John Sowers, the Solicitor General of the United States, they're doing a great job, their legal team, of pushing back against the leftists' lawfare of trying to thwart the will of the people, and we're winning. So I think the tide is turning, but this story is really about those dark days and what did we do to fight back.
And I'm speaking with Senator Eric Schmidt. His new book is The Last Line of Defense, How to Beat the Left in Court. You can get that on Amazon now or wherever books are sold. And it's the number one bestseller on Amazon in the United States judicial branch. So congratulations for that. And this also deals with not just the courage to fight back, but out of control judges. Because even if you have the best argument, the constitutionally correct argument, when you have out of control leftist judges on the bench, then how do you deal with that? And how are you now in the U.S. Senate, not as a litigator, but as a senator, dealing with expediting these nominations to get some of these Trump judges confirmed?
Yeah, I mean, actually, the first four district court judges that President Trump put forward all worked in the Attorney General's office with me when I was AG. So we're getting the first four out of the gate are good judges that see the law as it is, not how they want it to be. So we're trying to Missouri's doing its part, but we need to get more rule of law judges on the bench. I think that's all coming, and we're going to try to expedite that moving forward. But I guess the good news, here's the good news, and you would appreciate this. When I was in law school in the late 90s, you still had this kind of living constitution nonsense that people talked about. You had a left-leaning court that would basically try to just get to a result, you know, and the law didn't matter. Originalism was still kind of a, you know, thing that nobody really talked about. Scalia and Thomas really forced their way into the zeitgeist of what we all kind of accept to be true now. And because of that, and what President Trump did with the three nominees, we have a relatively conservative Supreme Court. And I don't mean like they have this share every political view that I have, but they believe the Constitution is fixed. They believe that the laws are what they are. They don't get to change them because they want some different results. That provides a huge opportunity for us to establish really important precedent. And I think these random district court judges like a Boasberg, who's, you know, somehow got all these cases in the middle of the night, even though he wasn't the emergency docket judge in D.C., you know, despite some of those cases, what President Trump now is successful on, and I think this is part of the playbook, is he's winning on his decisions on personnel and programming, like take the USAID stuff, cutting out all that nonsense. He's winning as those cases make their way up to the appellate courts and Supreme Court on nationwide injunctions. The Supreme Court stepped in and said, yeah, you can't do that anymore. It's ridiculous. It's being abused. It's supposed to be at the parties in front of you at the district court level. And on deportations, there's just a decision yesterday by an appellate court on temporary protected status. All the manipulation that took place under Joe Biden to let 20 million people here illegally, they're unwinding that. And the courts are saying, yes, you can do that. You are following immigration law. So I think that's the good news as they make their way up. We have a playing field now that's more fair for us to, if we have the courage to fight back, go out and win. And I think in the book, Last Line of Defense, it's what are some of those decisions along the way that matter? Like the Missouri versus Biden lawsuit where we uncovered the vast censorship enterprise. Normally in a lawsuit like that, you try to get an injunction, meaning to stop the government from doing bad things right away. But we knew it was so, people were calling it conspiracy theory. It was so high profile. We sought discovery first before we sought the injunction. And then that was a key decision because all the stuff came out, the emails, the text messages. We were able to take Fauci's deposition. We took Elvis Chan's deposition and really unveiled that case to the American people, which I think has kind of helped revitalize free speech in our country too.
Yeah, well said. And, you know, to your point about how law school teaches this kind of notion of a fluid constitution as opposed to originalism, I was talking earlier in the program about this question that's kind of simmering on the right about whether or not the Constitution is still effective in maintaining order and preserving our way of life. It seems like the left has totally abandoned that and they're willing to break all of the rules, and the right is still for law and order and the principles laid out in our Declaration. But it's very difficult when you have one side that's literally just willing to have total double standards, no rules at all. What's your view on the Constitution as a whole and how we fit this into the overall framework of how to beat the left in court?
I think it's a symptom of two things. One, we don't teach civics anymore. And two, the Democrats have been captured by the left and effectively neo-Marxists, right? I mean, you know, basically DEI is sort of cultural Marxism, right? It's pitting one group against another and there's no rules, right? It's just about the result. But I do think the reason why civics are so important, I think, in understanding is that the founders understood the excesses of government all around them. Historically, they had just, you know, they were rebelling against an authoritarian government, a king that was suppressing speech and trying to take their guns away, right? So what they did was they created a system in the Constitution that spread out power, separation of powers, federalism, and all of that was meant to guard and protect individual liberty. That was the whole point. So they so that you can live your life and pursue happiness, they create all these protections. And so sometimes it gets frustrating with government. Why doesn't it do this? Why doesn't it do that? It's supposed to be hard to do things, and you want to spread out that power, and you have each branch kind of jealously guarding their power and you know, and kind of fighting with one another along the way, because then you that's a way to protect individual liberty. Well, if you don't actually believe in the goal, if you're just a collectivist, like that's a barrier to you getting your way. And I think that's right. I mean, New York Times just had an editorial, right, about how you should abolish the Senate, upend the Constitution. If the Democrats ever have what we have, which is a Senate House and a White House, they will end the filibuster. They will pack the court. They will add D.C. and Puerto Rico to the union. This is what they're campaigning on. So we should take them at their word. And so if you want to understand why, you know, maybe reading The Last Line of Defense is important to understand that landscape. If you want to understand why it's important to be engaged, if you want to understand why elections matter, that's it. Because if we lose, we're not just losing on like some, you know, tax issue, right? We're losing on the big stuff.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for fighting, Senator Eric Schmidt, and for writing this book, The Last Line of Defense, How to Beat the Left in Court. Go get it today. I'm really excited to read it. Follow Eric Schmidt at Eric_Schmidt. And thank you so much. Our AFR family is praying for you and others in Washington. So thank you so much. And as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.